Hi, everyone. This is Holly Herndon.
I'm Matt Dryhurst.
And you're listening to
Interdependence.
Yes, hello.
Hey.
It's 2 minutes early. What do we do now?
We're so happy that it's working.
I want to know, are you going to continue your music career?
Of course.
Yeah. I really love that part. So the podcast is actually, you know, kind of side work. What is the main work?
Exactly. So the main work is the artwork. And also Matt just started a kind of organization. But the main work is the artwork. And the podcast is actually kind of conversations that we would have anyways, but we're just making them available to the public. So people that we would enjoy speaking with about kind of prescient topics. Yeah, we just kind of record them and it's pretty casual. It's definitely not our main thing, but it's something that we enjoy.
And what is his agency?
We've been working with AI for 6 years. And there's kind of a big problem where the technology has come really far and it's really impressive to make artwork with. But oftentimes people are making artwork with the art of others. And there's no kind of way for the actual artists who are creating the original works to make any money from that. So we're trying to start a company to solve that problem.
Can we start this conversation about that subject? Because it's very interesting for me.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's talk about this, the ownership and author rights. You know, I start working with the most difficult form of art, which is definitely, you know, performance. And when I start in early 70s, this was some kind of like first woman walking on the moon territory. Yeah. And so few artists was doing that because, you know, this is difficult. Nobody have anything to sell. You know, the galleries, nothing to sell, museums, nothing to show. And it was immaterial. And everything, you know, you do is it's in the beginning. Artists also decide not to take any kind of document, no photograph, no video was taken because it would be very radical. Later we understood that we have to start, you know, taking documentation because otherwise we will be completely dismissed from history. As we are. And you know, it was at the time that actually us was no kind of established any rules in the beginning. That rules actually never been established till I made some rules. And I understood that the you know, because so many video artists and the performance artists stopped working already in early 80s. And everybody turned to video. And there was, you know, this old thing about, you know, the people dying from AIDS, and it was a big kind of revival. So lots of things happened. People start painting and creating goods to sell. And very few artists, like I'm one of them, who actually didn't want to go back and wanted to continue to work performance. And so right now, you know, I'm one of the few, my generation, I mean, getting November 76 is kind of not exactly early age. You know, I'm still doing this stuff. So I was thinking that we need really to protect this territory. So I understood that everybody was taking out the performance. You know, like a fashion designer or fashion photographers were just looking the books from the 70s of different performance artists, like a Steven Maisel. Yeah. He was like literally copying the work of 70s, just putting fashion models in the clothes and actually recreating that kind of shots. And then, you know, the artists didn't have any kind of possibility to get lawyers. I mean, they never been paid for their work. And then to get the lawyers, you know, to sue Steven Maisel was impossible. I understand that I wrote to his manager the letter because the Italian Vogue in the reproduced the photo of me and Ulay doing the relation work piece where he have a cover and he have like 10 spreads inside and you know he got very well paid with doing the Vogue cover and we never got 1 cent doing this piece. So I send I send to the manager the letter and I say, you know, it's really, if he's inspired, you know, by our work, you should really mention that. And I never got any response and absolutely ignored. So, And I was faced with so many of these kind of problems. But apart of this, so many artists have the same issue. Like, you know, the MTV was copying theater pieces, the film, the design, the you know, just everywhere was you could find something for performance without any credits. And because of that, I made a piece in Guggenheim Museum called Seven Easy Pieces. And Seven Easy Pieces for me was actually the proof and showing the way how with the dignity, if you wanted to be inspired by work of art, you know, what you should do. So I chose seven easy pieces, which are most difficult I can imagine, but not really easy. It was just more like a metaphor, including one of my work that of different artists that I will reperform in Guggenheim. For that, I ask permission of artists to give me the permission to do this. If the artist is dead, I will ask foundation. I will pay artists and I will pay foundation, and I will study the material and I will make my own version. And in that my version, there will be catalog, and in the catalog, there will be absolutely notice the original title, the original photographs of the work, and, you know, interpretation. And this was the way how it should be done. And after that, you know, I actually started receiving the requests of the artists who want to reperform my work and start really kind of being good, except I will never give the repetition or the permission of anybody who will do something to danger his life, like Rhythm Zero, some other works, Resident Energy. They are dangerous, and I took, you know, my own risk. But this kind of thing, nobody territory or performance art, is very similar to this new technology now. It's exactly the same problem. And this is why, to me, is also interesting NFT, because in NFT is so immaterial. And in 20th century, somebody asked me a long time ago, he said, what is the, you know, future of art? And I always said the future of art is immaterial, is a transmission of pure energy between artists and audience. And somehow we are having this actually happening. So this was my take on this, how we should really take serious the rights of an artist.
It's super relevant to everything that we're thinking about as well, this kind of intersection of crypto and machine learning. I think they're both definitely like the kind of emergent spaces. I find it really interesting that there was this kind of tendency against documentation in the early days as a kind of just focus on being present, but how that kind of limited the travel of those kind of works. And to look at that from today's perspective, from an AI machine learning perspective, documentation can now be used to create and spawn entirely new works from that documentation. So the documentation itself is used as kind of training material. So for example, I could train a machine learning model on your performances, and I could model your voice, I could model your physical appearance, I could model your kind of your presence even. I think it's a really prescient conversation.
It's really tricky because on the one hand, and it does very much relate to NFTs as well, I think, is that on the one hand, documentation establishes provenance, right? It's kind of, as you mentioned before, it's like a record to kind of prove that this thing existed, right? There was, you know, there's a photograph that's taken at this particular point in time. But at the same time, that media can also be repurposed to train. And so there's always this dance between wanting to kind of prove that something exists and give people access to something, and also try and protect the intentions of the original artwork or the artistic gesture and the artists themselves. And all of that seems like it needs to be figured out, you know? And what's encouraging, I think, is that most artists generally are quite interested in figuring these things out, in the sense of not wanting to kind of prohibit people from doing stuff, encouraging experimentation. But it also takes artists themselves, I think, to step up and think of models for how to make this kind of fair or useful, because people don't tend to represent the interests of artists very much unless they demand it.
I can write the book about it, how we are misused, used, and raped through our art practice. But listen, it's really important to talk about problems. The problems of documentation is huge. And I was addressing this in all my life, you know, 50 years of career now, because in the earliest time, we didn't have any kind of practice or knowledge how to actually tell the photographer what to photograph. So we would just be so eager because such a new media, let's do performance, we focus on public and performance, and photographer will come in and photograph without actually knowing what's going to happen because it's unpredictable in many ways and without getting to him any kind of instructions. This was in the beginning. So why documentation is so bad and poor and difficult and gray and misinterpretation and the video works are like all over the place, you know, and it's interesting to address the reasons why it was like that. Because as we never got, you know, I remember in the beginning, I just want to give example of one of the, when I understood that I have to give very specific instructions. It was the piece when I made a video piece, you know, the first video, you know, there was no video, it was just Super 8 camera, but came the video. I remember I was doing a piece in Denmark called Art Must Be Beautiful, Art Must Be Beautiful. They say, oh, there's going to be video. And I was so excited. So the guy came and filmed. And immediately after performance, which I done in the front of the public, I asked him to see the video. I was so excited. When I saw the video, I was shocked. It was the most terrible shit I ever saw in my life. Because the guy, you know, the old piece was really about me combing the hair with the metal comb and metal brush, kind of, you know, giving this image of the sarcastic idea that art should not be beautiful, art should not match the carpet in your living room. It have to be something else. It'll be disturbing, asking questions, so on and so on. The guy who's filming my feet, solarization, left, right, you know, moving the camera, taking off and off, you know, just experimenting like a new media. Camera was new media. So he was experimenting every possibility with camera, regardless of what I was doing. I asked him to delete this material on the spot. He was shocked. And he pressed the button and delete. Then I told him, I'm going now, you know, the public is gone. I'm going to do entire performance one more time, imagining the camera is the public. And I want to place the camera. I want to exactly focus on what I'm interested in. I want you to press the button and I want you to go smoke a cigarette. And no, come back till it's finished. And he exactly did it. And I got the piece I wanted. Then I realized that I have to spend the same amount of energy of building the work, performing the work, also instructing the photographer and the documentator what they're going to actually focus on. You know, if you see the early 70s performers, everybody from Joseph Beuys, Bruce Nauman, all of this, you know, Vito Conti, if they didn't give instruction, you know, the photographer will come in. What if performance was 3 hours? They will come in. They will film something on the left. Maybe something more important is happening on the right. They will in and out. They will go smoke the cigarette, come back, miss part of the piece. And this will be documentation. But that documentation didn't represent fully the piece. And when I done this artist, the 7 Easy Pieces, it was so important to me to reconstruct exactly from the material, like being archaeologist with in the finest detail, what really happened from the people who witnessed, from the writings, from the different documents, all the partial parts of information that I actually can know what peace was. When I done the work, the Joseph Beuys, the talking to dead hair about art, you know, I went to his wife and she gave me some documents that nobody knew. There were some documents from the TV program that was filmed at the time and completely kind of ridicule him. But in the same time, camera was showing some of the very important parts of the work that I can reconstruct and put in the piece. And, you know, right now, what is interesting after the lesson of 70s, now we have, you have the great work of art of 70s, who is badly documented and bad representation. And you have shitty art of the 20s and 23rd, 5s, whatever, or some artists who are incredibly well documented with the high technology, but the work is not good. It's kind of really interesting, you know, to go through this jungle and find new way out.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I was just thinking that when you were saying that we had kind of the inverse problem around the net art era where, you know, the documentation was superior to the work itself. You would see it on Instagram and you'd be like, wow, that looks amazing. Then you go to the gallery and it looked terrible. Matt and I actually did a piece years ago called Being There for a brass ensemble where we wrote in the score what the documentation crew should be doing at what moment. So it was actually for documentation crew and brass ensemble, because we were trying to acknowledge at that moment that probably more people would view the piece online than they're physically present in that moment. It wasn't necessarily the most successful piece that we've done, but it was definitely an early attempt. But I think
because
this is
really
interesting.
The camera is so good. The camera is so good. Technology is so perfect, you know.
No,
but
is,
if,
yeah.
if you just think about a very simple thing, how actually this take away our real experience. I remember so well when, you know, like San Marco in Venice, this most beautiful square, you know, and how it looked wonderful, and how many tourists took these photographs, and you see the square in so many different ways, and lights, sunset and sunrise and whatever possible angles. And then you go there and you experience reality is taken away because of that. And yeah. This is one way, and another way that actually you don't look the reality because you're taking photographs before you even get in. And yeah. And then you see this reality as a flashback, basically, at your home, showing to the friends, but you didn't experience.
Yeah, it's funny. It reminds me of, I forget what it's called. It's called like Paris syndrome or something, which is like a strange phenomenon that was common with tourists coming from Japan who had seen so much documentation of Paris that when they arrived there, they were so disappointed that it gave them like a trauma of some kind. And this is actually a thing. You can look it up. It was like a big issue in like the 80s or something like this, that they would see all these images. And then when they got there, it was so different to the documented experience that it would like break something. And
this is really interesting though, tying into the machine learning conversation, because, you know, you think about using like your personal training data to create this kind of like perfect model of yourself. But of course, there's always the eye of the photographer or the kind of perspective of the documentarian.
It's Photoshop.
Kind of a hybrid. Photoshop. Right. It's kind of whatever version of yourself you're putting in there.
Yep.
And then, you know, I had a Chinese friend who showed me the app that you look yourself like unbelievable. I mean, the kitsch of the kitsch. You just, you know, take photo of any kind of you, and then you press this up, and then you turn into this Chinese beauty geisha style. Oh, my God. But, you know, my first experience about misinterpretation of reality was in ex-Yugoslavia when I was born. And that was, I was in my 20s, you know, and study art academy. And there was, the book on Impressionism. And the way that we can study, it was from the Russian books, because Russian books was very, you know, the glossy and the print. And the print was with so much color, and there was so thick. They will put actually talc paper that you have to kind of roll in order not to have the colors on your hands and all over your dress, and then finally when you take off this talc powder, you see the impressionism, and the color was so incredibly live and like almost psychedelic, and I remember going to Paris and seeing the real, I was the most disappointed. Everything was like gray and dull. And I said, this is not the same I've been learned, you know, at school. So this was the first time that I understood misinterpretation of the reproduction and reality. But this is something that with a new technology have a lot. So how we can solve this problem, how we can make some, you know, but at the same time, everything new, you somehow have to settle down. And that people are not impressed with technology, but they're more interested in content.
Yeah, it's funny. It's one thing. I mean, so, you know, we've discussed on this podcast a lot. We've been talking a lot about crypto, Web3, kind of NFTs. And that's one thing that I think is actually quite interesting is that, you know, one of the ideas we often explore is the fact that when you establish these kind of new systems of provenance, where, for example, on an open blockchain, everybody can see all the commerce, you know, you can see all the interactions, you can see, in often cases, in the most idealistic case, you can see, let's say, everybody whose work contributed to make an artwork happen. We were describing it as a shock of the nude, you know, where you're used to maybe in the 20th century seeing most like modes of cultural production through the lens of promotion. When you deal with like a record or something like this, like everything, the way that people would receive an artist before is they would see the printed record, they would see the glamorous photographs. And then increasingly over time with the advent of the internet, these superficial aspects have both been increased, but have also been torn away a little bit. You have like more access to the truth. And in some ways, that's one thing I think think is really encouraging about this Web3 idea, at least, is it's kind of showing the guts, you know? And actually, when you show the guts, ultimately those guts become something that you can then do something with. But it's a very denuding kind of, like, it is a very naked process.
But, you know, the tree space, I really very interesting to see how they can continue and what will develop. Because, you know, talking about art, it was interesting when, you know, one, in the early days, you really look art and you know, and it does something to you. But then it's then become a commodity, and then the price was attached to the work. And then what you see the price before the work, which is kind of incredible. I mean, starting from Maurizio Cattelan banana on the wall for 150,000 to the, I don't know, to Van Gogh of 35 million. And then, you know, you're looking the value before you actually see what work is about. The first thing with NFT that we actually knew about it, it was 62 million what was sold on the market. That was the first before anything what actually was about. And that's really what was disturbing and took me off. Right. And it took me a long time to go back and to see there must be other layers to this.
So what was it that actually brought you back? Because it feels like so much of the art world has kind of rejected the notion of the NFT. So I'm wondering what brought you back and why do you think so many other people are rejecting it? You think it's just this kind of initial shock of the commerce around it, or do you think there's something more there?
You know, because it started reminding me very much of my start with the performance art in the 70s and the video art in the 70s and the 80s, you know, that we had the same problems. It's exactly the same problems, a complete rejection. You know, people ridiculed this whole media, not being accepted as any art form and so on. And then, you know, 30, 40 years later, it's all parts of the museum. I mean, you know, the video and photography was never been accepted as a mainstream, but then was much actually earlier accepted than performance. Performance, I really think from it, finally with my show in the Museum of Modern Art in 2010, it was the first time that performance entered the museum, you know, and that's something changed. Mm-hmm. You know, to me, it was a very good example. With video, because video, as I said, you know, everybody was so inspired by, you know, the idea that you can film everything, that you can do whatever. And then it was terrible. There was nothing good till Nam June Paik arrived. And when Nam June Paik arrived, he filmed the Buddha, put the Buddha, and you see him on the TV screen, and put the real Buddha facing the Buddha in TV screen. And or he take the screens and create the video garden. And these people start thinking, they don't think any more technology. They think about meaning and they think about content and they think about art. And he really made this bridge. And this is now we are waiting for that bridge to be made. And it takes time and it's slow. But I think the W3, the people are really interested. People, they're young, they're fresh, and there is something there that we can expect wonder.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, it's also been strange, you know, for us personally, we've been contributing in kind of the crypto Web3 space for quite a few years. I mean, going back to like maybe 2014 or something like this. And I actually remember reading your statement talking about how it reminded you a little bit of, you know, the challenges of performance art, where you start out with a lot of people who were doing something out of kind of curiosity and experimentation, and kind of looking for maybe a means to make that more sustainable, or in some cases not even looking for that. And then that perspective changing over time. And I feel like that's very much what happened with the kind of crypto conversation. You know, actually NFTs weren't really a big discussion until 2017 or something like this, and then didn't become a big public discussion until the last couple of years. And so it's really peculiar seeing like the embers of something that, in my mind, I would argue is exactly as you described. You know, it's been one of the most powerful and kind of just interesting experimental spaces for a long time now, kind of being hijacked a little bit by these big prices and by, you know, and by these kind of big news stories. And so I very much appreciate your acknowledging the space for that, because that's kind of my experience of it.
But also, you know, when I decided to do this hero, it was I didn't come into the NFT with the new work. I came with old work. I came with something that I done so many years ago and was dedicated to my father. But I saw the potential that one work of art can many lives and that can be seen in different ways. It's I don't know if you know the piece called Balkan Baroque, when I washed the bones. It was It was in relation to the war in Balkan. And I wanted to make something very much to do with my own country and shame of the war. But in the same time, I have in mind that I should make something transcendental, something that any war can use this image. It doesn't matter if it's Afghanistan or Syria or Iran or now Ukraine, that actually can serve that purpose. And this is why I think to put this hero into NFT and see how that's going to work could really be interesting. And in the beginning, I was thinking about more or less, you know, to the benefit of part of the money goes to Ukraine. But I already done some benefits for Ukraine, and I think so many people are helping it. And I think thinking deeply what our planet need now, they need really the idea of heroes. They need people who really believe in something, believe in the cause, sacrifice their life for that cause, and something like old-fashioned heroism, because we are really surrounded by bullshit, the leaders, and by people without any moral quality. So this is something that I'm thinking, and I have now with the Pussy Riot, the podcast today, 4 o'clock, what we're going to talk about that platform and see what we can do together. Because they are also new heroes for me, these kids.
Yeah, absolutely. So for context for those listening, you know, you're releasing this work, The Hero, that was, I believe it was shot in 2001.
2001, The Death of My Father. Yeah,
exactly. So you're releasing this as a series, and as part of that,
it's individual frames from the video.
It's individual frames from the video. It's a very beautiful image.
But the part of this, the close-ups, are I never made as artwork. This is totally material that I film, but I never use it. So I think it's a good moment to have the original one, and then also additional part that actually the close-up and the wind and flag. And don't ever ask me how I make horse stand still with so much wind. this was really complicated.
Yeah, and so as far as I understand as well, part of the work, speaking about this heroes aspect, part of the work, part of the idea is that some of the proceeds from the work will then go to create grants
in the Web3 space.
In the Web3 space for people who want to propose ideas, ideas of scope in kind of the real world.
To me, that place is really like a treasure who is going to bloom and we have some new things. Plus, you know, look at the age. What is the youngest person in this place? Do you know the age?
In the Web3 space?
Yeah.
We collect from a Japanese child who I think is 8 years old.
this is my people. Exactly. You see? Because this
genuinely
is
though, yeah. I mean, there's some people in the DeFi space. There's a whole crew of kids who are like 12 years old in DeFi. I forget what they're called, but yeah, there's a lot of
Zombie Zoo.
Is the young artist that we've collected. Yeah, there's a lot of very young people.
You know, when I do lectures, I just done one lecture in Lithuania in Kaunas, and it was, you know, it was on the webinars, and they could not fit so many people, so they have to rent the basketball stadium, 6,000 people. And I asked them, it's the first time I had so many people in my life, and I asked them, what is the youngest? And the youngest person there was 12, and the oldest was, you know, 55. Nobody my age, nobody over 55, but there was a huge amount of young people. And these young people, to me, is the audience that then I mean that my work live, if I can have this kind of audience. My, you know, my generation sucks generally.
Yeah, we had a similar, it's funny, we did a presentation at Art Dubai.
Oh, yeah, and they opened it up for questions, and the most kind of difficult question came from a child.
Well, child, I mean, yeah, he must have been like 11 or 12, and it was the most complex, and I'm not even being charitable, it genuinely was, like it was the most complex question that we received, and I was like, oh, wow, okay, yeah.
But these kids already grown, they grow up with the technology that we didn't even know exist. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're completely advanced. They're like, new children on this planet who probably will find solution.
So let's talk about the concept of the hero for a minute. You know, it seems like our culture is so obsessed with villains at the moment and more skeptical of hero narratives, maybe because they're, you know, we're kind of questioning some of our histories of, you know, who we were taught were heroes and, you know, trying to figure out who was left out and how perspectives were were maybe false in the past. But so how do we kind of forge a way forward with the hero narrative while acknowledging that humans are imperfect and flawed and they're going to make mistakes and the heroes are going to let us down in some ways, but how can we still have them as heroes? Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally, totally. But you know, this is such a great question, a non-existing answer, because, you know, through hundreds and hundreds of years, we are the people who are cruel and killing and making wars and never learn the lesson. And this is repeating over and over again. But in thousands of these years, here and there, every kind of century come one person or maybe a group of people who are different. And we are looking for that type of people. I mean, if you think about Gandhi, I mean, I think that every politician today, before he become politician, she should start the biography of Gandhi. Gandhi was such a great example of being humble, modesty, and morality. At the same time, he made the entire revolution in India without dropping one drop of blood. He was an example of nonviolent. I mean, that was definitely one great example. You know, so we should never give up on humanity, because here and there somebody will happen. For me, you know, for my own people, Nikola Tesla, it was incredible. Nikola Tesla invented electricity that our planet can produce electricity with no any cost. And of course, because of the nationals and the money that people are making on all these sources of energy, they totally took away this possibility. But there are people who really think they're out of the box and think for the well-being of humankind and survival of the planet. And there are not many, but let's look for them.
Yeah, we have to make it cool again to be hopeful.
Yeah, we're definitely, I mean, part of the exercise, I mean, one, you know, this podcast is designed to just kind of make the conversations we have in the studio open. But the other part is there's very much an emphasis on like an optimism, even though it can be very difficult to maintain, given the many twists and surprises that the world has. It's kind of like, it's really nice to have conversations with people fundamentally who are interested in building things and not destroying them.
But look at, I was just thinking, let's look in the past and say, okay, what I will really enjoy, which period, you know, to live. I mean, I'm just living now in most difficult, the period of invisible danger of all these different the viruses who are around us and the wars and stuff and possible nuclear war and possible, you know, the warming of the planet and sea rising and whatever. But what you think about 50s? I was just thinking with nostalgia. 50s was amazing. It was after Second World War. Look at America. America, everybody drive the car with one hand. The darling, do you fix me a drink when the husband come home? Everybody smoked cigarettes. There was Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. All the Hollywood movies was about happiness and happy ending. I remember coming from communism, looking to American wonderful world, the world with that people have a chewing gums in six colors. I mean, jeans, all of, it was insane how that simple was and how much happiness was there after a huge disaster. Why we always have to have some terrible disaster that our consciousness change. And then, you know, and then we start thinking how life is so precious and how, you know, we have to, you know, live in the moment.
Okay, so I'm hearing that it's cyclical and that we're going to hit an apex of doom and then and then the optimism can start again.
I'm particularly interested. So looking back to the hero work, I also think it's kind of interesting that that work was filmed in 2001. And I was looking back because I was alive in 2001 and I do remember that the internet really wasn't a thing then. And part of me wants to ask you, because you have this context, you know, you see this kind of this new wave with NFTs and these new experiments now of trying to kind of value, let's say, immaterial works or digital works. Do you see any interesting kind of correlations with around about when this work would have been shot, around about the advent of the early internet? Like, what were conversations were you having at that time when all of a sudden, you know, there were people out there saying that everyone's going to be communicating through a device in their pocket. I wonder if you see any correlation there.
You know, right now, you know, first of all, technology, I just accept so late in my age, computer. I don't have Instagram. I don't have Twitter. I don't have any of this. My institute does, because they're run by all young people, but not me, myself. You know, I was so nostalgic about the idea of writing the letter and then walking your dog to post office and then, you know, putting the stamp on the letter, sending the letter. And you knew that for at least the next 7 days, you'll be in peace because nobody will answer you. And then you receive the letter and then wait for another week and then you answer the letter. And then the horror of internet for me was the worst because the technology was actually invented that human beings have time for himself. But technology was so addictive that entire amount of time that you have for yourself is taken away from you because you're addicted to technology. And, you know, with starting the writing the emails, you write the email and I'm always trying to answer every single the question in email that I don't receive another one. I'm already on the end of the day, you receive another email with additional question, which is like, and what are you doing tomorrow or whatever, just to continue. So it's never ending. That never ending drives me crazy because this is so manipulative and taking time. And what we are doing with no time, we are completely deconcentrated about ourselves. You know, for me, as an artist, doing nothing, absolutely nothing, is not crime. It's not something that we are ashamed because of society. Or what are you doing today? And you say, I'm doing nothing. Because doing nothing is to happen something. Because then you can really have time to think in a kind of creative way. But if this time is taken away by technology, you're just kind of automat. And you become this machine who fit in the technology. It's a big problem.
This is a huge problem. This is something that we probably struggle. This is like probably the thing we struggle with the most is just taking that time to daydream and think and imagine rather than kind of like sitting at the computer and trying to hammer something out in the studio and like make something happen rather to just kind of allow it to happen.
What it's difficult too, because it's also an economic pressure, right? It becomes the economy. And you could say this the same around the arts too. The economy changes to such an extent so as to satisfy the ways in which these technologies have proliferated, right? And so it becomes increasingly expensive also to take that time.
You know, the another thing that is terrible, we stop dreaming. People don't dream anymore, the dreams, or even the dream, they don't remember it because of the sleeping pills or the television is running on or whatever, we're exhausted to dream. You know, I created something called Dream Hotel in Japan. I done this actually now 15 years ago, and you can go there and all what you have to do is to dream the dream in a special way. You know, you are prepared for it and then write in the dream book. I just published the dream book. And it's so important to kind of go into simplicity. There was one friend of mine, I don't want to say the name, but he was a Nobel Prize winner. And he said, if the human being doesn't go back to simplicity, you know, entire technology will take it over. You know, artificial intelligence, whatever. They will start thinking for us. They will do things for us. And that's such a huge, really problem. And, you know, I create an entire institute in which I teach Abramovich method. Abramovich method, you go to the course where you 5 days don't eat and don't talk and do exercises in order to enlarge your consciousness, to create, you know, the space for your mind to actually can think, and doing very simple repetitive exercises. And it's very beneficial, actually, that you get to that kind of space that you don't even know exists anymore.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. This reminds me of the kind of paradox of the AI replacement fantasy. So this idea that you can kind of create the perfect machine to make art for you so that you then have enough free time to do things like make artwork.
This is or you train your monkey to do it for you. No, it's kind of incredible, you know, all of this technology, you know, robot who make you coffee in the morning or you do this, you do that, but you still sit on the computer and answer every single message and you don't let it go. Like now in my shows, you know, which I done in London with 513 hours, then you're going to go to have some experience. You have to put your computer, your watch and your telephone in the locker and then you go into the space. It's the only way. And then the people start staying for hours because they don't check the time. They can really go into experience. And finally, when they can get the phone back, they don't want to put the phone on immediately because they understood how great it is. I remember a kid came to my exhibition. He was 12 years old and he put headphones and he said to me, "But they don't work." I said, "Of course don't work because it's about silence." He was shocked. He never heard silence in his life when they put the headphone on. It's always some music. And he brought entire his class next day. All of them, they come to listen to silence.
Well, thinking about this kind of addiction that we have to technology, and I certainly am guilty of this as well. You know, I see especially young people, you know, they're kind of growing up, dressing up and constantly performing for each other online. Like it's almost like this, yeah, interactive performance practice that people have via social media. So I'm wondering, how do you think that impacts performance moving forward?
But you know, it's so difficult. You go to the restaurant, you see two young people sitting opposite each other and each of the other texting and not talking. It's so sad. It's so sad that actually that there is no emotional interaction. The group of kids who are actually doing all the video games just by talking to each other on the devices, but they're not having any kind of interaction. And this is why my performances are super simple. So this is why you finally decide to see something and you you do it. You know, you get incredibly emotional move. There is this friend of mine, he's art critic, and said, "I hate your work." I said, "Why?" "Because you always make me cry." Because they don't want, you know, because it's not about thinking. It's not about, it's about feeling. And the feeling, to me, the very important part of performance is to feel, to emotionally to be involved. And of course, you have to be good. You can't, that's small detail.
Do you think that's possible in an online space? I mean, so much of your work is about, like, you know, putting the phone away, being present, being physically there. Like, do you think that you could achieve some of those same goals in an online space, or do you think it's fundamentally at odds?
I think that you have to actually really involve that kind of, you know, the space, you know, the new technology in order to get to these young people. Otherwise, there's no way to make the contact. So I think it's really important to get them there and then turn them around and bring them to simplicity. I think there is a way. You know, it's really interesting. You know, to me, the most dangerous is virtual. You know, the virtual technology. And I think that one good thing is mixed reality, because in the other one, you know, you are totally. Your body is not there anymore. Everything is in the head. Everything is in the brain. And you're completely taken off the reality. But the mixed technology, you still have reality and you have this mixed reality coming in. And that with that mixed reality can be the road to take to another type of meditation, simplicity, being present, and so many other things. So I think, you know, we have to be positive about technology and see how we can, you know, bring something good. Optimism, after all.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, it's true. And I agree with you. I mean, generally mixed reality, augmented reality kind of applications are so much more interesting to me than the virtual reality side, even though they kind of come hand in hand. And I also think in some ways, actually, podcasting has done this where, you know, it's like social media has been so frenetic and actually there's been such an increased demand for people to just listen to people talk for hours on end.
Without a video, without an image.
Without a video, without an image.
Just the intimacy of the voice.
Exactly. And strangely enough, it's like podcasting to me, I find it also kind of more intimate and allows my brain to kind of travel a bit more than just consuming content constantly. It's So I think I'm quietly optimistic that actually these are fundamental needs for humans, and that ultimately those fundamental needs will win out, even though it's going to be
I agree totally. And, you know, remind me on the old days with the radio. You know, in the old days, there was no television and the radio was everything you heard. And I sitting around the radio and listening to the theater play and listening to the stories and listening to the music. And then you have all your imagination, you know, so much working out, because the images you create your own in your head. And this is why, to me, podcast without images is great. I remember very well the one of my journey in India some time ago. I end in the Tamil Nadu, one of the poorest area of India, in the village. And once a week on the weekend, they will have the guys carry the literally donkey with the generator and the big screen. They put, actually it's not even the screen, they're just the bed sheet, you know, they will put on the wires in the middle of the village, and all kids will run with the chairs and sit in the front of that screen, and they will show the movie. And I remember everybody was there, and I took my chair and I sit, but the something was wrong with the projector. So there was no movie, but there was a sound, and they project full sound of the cartoon, Tom and Jerry. And everybody was laughing on the right spot without seeing an image. And it was incredible. And you know, cartoon is, oh, wow, hey, wow, you know, it's just sounds. But everybody knew what's going on. And I really find that the power of sound is really important, and it's very good in this time, because then you have time to actually make your own image.
This actually leads me to something that I wanted to ask you before, when we were talking about how you brought performance to the institution, to the museums, and it was something that was kind of hadn't been done before. And also around this kind of like crypto conversation, you know, we're seeing people start to see creative contracts and software as artworks, which maybe hasn't been so widespread before. And this is something that I kind of struggle with a little bit as a musician who doesn't really feel like I have the perfect home in the music industry. I'm kind of in between worlds. And I know that you're a music lover and a sound lover. So I'm curious, why do you think that music is often not treated as a fine art and rather as maybe an entertainment? And, it kind of suffers from some of the same immateriality as performance and digital art. But I wonder why we still have this kind of barrier between like something that's presented as fine art or something that's presented as music?
It's kind of a wonderful question, because, you know, every time that I've been asked, you know, about music, performance, you know, the rest of the art, I always create a kind of visual pyramid. On the top of pyramid is always music. On the second level is performance, and then everything else. But absolutely top.
But the I like top this pyramid.
But the top has always been music, much more than performance, because music is the most immaterial of all. Reach you everywhere. Your sound reach you end of the world. You can go to Zanzibar, you can go to New Guinea, whatever, there is a sound. And this is to me, and why it's so difficult, because it's the most immaterial of everything. But it's the most powerful also. You know, you have the power that any other media don't. You know, that you can create concert, you can do music when 500,000 people in trance. You know, that's a power. And I think it's, you know, whatever is going to happen historically, you know, you have the power. You don't need to have, you know, be accepted or not accepted, because you move everybody. Sound moves people.
This is very true. And this is also why I love listening to folk music traditions from around the world, because you really hear that power that's gone, you know, through the ages and has been moving people in different ways through the ages.
Well, it's the one thing you can be absolutely sure will happen. And I think it speaks a lot to your work, too, because a lot of your work is actually about kind of a lot of people congregate to be in space with you, you know, and it's one of these things that it really doesn't matter whatever new technological thing comes along. I can guarantee that in 500 years' time, people will desire to congregate in space and perform for each other. This is kind of like the fundamental. That's kind of how it started.
The and human need.
It's how it started, and it's how it will end.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's true. It's true. So optimism everywhere. Wow. Can I tell you? Can I tell you old fashioned? Can I tell you old fashioned performance joke now?
Please.
This is the only one joke I know, because there's no enough performance jokes. And humor, by the way, is so important. In optimism, humor is important. Which I like about His Holiness Dalai Lama, every conversation he will first start with a joke to open your heart and then hit you with a terrible truth. that's a great tactic. You know, we should always start with opening opening conversations with something funny. Anyway, this is the, because, you know, we are closing to end, so I just want to tell you the joke. So how many performance artists you need to fix light bulb on the ceiling? The answer is, I don't know. I was there only 6 hours.
That's good.
but you should have also the joke about music, you know. Next time when we talk, I will expect nothing but opening our conversation with a music joke.
Okay, I'll work on it.
We'll commit to the joke.
I'm going to take the second question. This is kind of ties in some of the things we were talking about earlier. So we've been working to create a kind of digital version of myself called Holly Plus through modeling my voice and working with my likeness. And I'm kind of allowing other people to make music with my voice. And so I'm curious how you would feel about something like this, you know, kind of creating a digital version of yourself, understanding that, of course, it isn't really you. It's just a kind of version of you. I wonder, you know, for me, I think about it in terms of, you know, part of opening up my archive and allowing the archive to be performed by others. And I also think about it in a kind of, not to be morbid, but in kind of like posthumous capacity of like, I like this idea of my voice being able to sing on after I'm no longer here. I'm wondering how you feel about that.
But actually, I give you my experience because I've done this already. I've done mixed reality. I've done already mixed reality piece called The Life. If you Google, you can see it. And the mixed reality piece Life, I've done this 2 years ago. And actually, I've been filmed with a 36 video camera because, you know, the other way how to do the, you know, they create the image by making many photographs of you and then render it and they create digital the version of you. But with video camera, you actually is real you, more you than you can possibly imagine, because, you know, if you just film yourself with one camera one dimensional, but through 336 camera, you create circles so that actually you project yourself into the space without any projections at all. So you can, the public can go through you, they can go around you and they can see you.
Right.
And this, my experience with this, I made the 17 minutes. It was so difficult to look myself. It was like you're creating literally you kind of, spirit of you, because it's like energy. You know, I just want to say something very different. You know, when the old people don't like to be photographed because they think they're going to die if their life is getting shorter by taking photograph. It's a kind of old story, especially in Italy, in Spain, and these kind of places. And the clairvoyants, they could see you give them 300 photographs, they can see the photographs who people are dying and who are alive because of life force. And it's kind of interesting, with 36 camera, you really kept life force. There is something there, like molecules of your energy are kept intact. And they can stay forever. And I think that I've done this now, but I really think that this could have much more value when I'm not there anymore. When I'm here, like, I'm live. But when I'm not, it's so much better to have that kind of vision of yourself than any photograph, any video, any other documentation, because it's much more superior. Technology gives you much more. So do it. But you have to wait till you die to be used.
Could you imagine someone performing the digital version of you, like controlling that avatar and coming up with new performance pieces kind of in your spirit posthumously? Or would that feel like, I don't know?
It's actually what is so funny. Now I have device, and this device, if you buy device and you plug in and you put your glasses, you see your own home, your own kitchen, and I'm there. Working, I mean, performing for you, or your garden, or your bedroom, or you, I don't know, the whatever, you know, living room. And this is so funny because that's actually, I made it and I'm not using it much. I'm not using it at all, but I know it's there and it's for the future, but it's there. It's called The Life. You can see it if you just Google The Life. It's my size, my everything. And when I look myself into myself, I tell you, it's not easy feeling at all.
I definitely have that when I hear my voice model singing back to me. I kind of cringe a little bit, but then I also learn how to fall in love with her again.
But you know what is important? It's so important. I actually would like to finish with one really advice to two of you, which is so important, to really try to look your life like for the first time every morning when you wake up. Don't be afraid of anything or anybody, and embody this feeling that artist is free human being and can make work out of dust, out of anything. And this is so beautiful to be, you know. It's really important to always don't repeat yourself, but surprise yourself with the new things.
Well, it's a very beautiful sentiment to end on. And it's been very lovely to hang
out. I was thinking this is a natural end.
Yeah.
You're good at this.
Exactly. You should get into podcasting.
You know, the performance is all about timing. Timing is essential. When you say the right thing, the right moment, you know, for the right public. Anyway, I really love talking to you, and your podcasts are very inspiring, and you have a great people there. I've been listening to a few of them, and I'm continue going to listen.
Thank you.
Wonderful.
Thanks so much. Well, I'm glad.
Wonderful. Well, hopefully we get to say hello in person one day, and have a wonderful week. And thanks again for your time.
Thank you so much for joining us today. This has been a real pleasure. And yeah, thank you for being so generous with your time.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.